Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Will, and what I'm going to be presenting is joint work with my colleagues Joe Calandrino and Ed Felton. Now, I'm going to be talking to you today about a topic most of you have probably not thought that deeply about, and that's bubble forms. Now, most of you are probably familiar with bubble forms, and you've likely used one at some point in your life, but just so we're all on the same page, bubble forms are the kind of forms that where a respondent is asked to mark a bubble or an empty circle, and that bubble usually corresponds to some kind of answer selection. So, bubble forms are widely used in a number of different usage cases, and the main reason is that they're really easy to use. You don't have to educate users, they don't have to be trained, and they have the added benefit that they allow accurate machine readability or input. So, the most common case where bubble forms are used are anonymous surveys, and here the identity of the respondent must be protected. Most cases in anonymous surveys, the respondents are promised the claim of anonymity, and if they don't believe this claim, then they're likely to answer certain questions differently. Another common case is standardized tests, and here we care about identity of the respondent in a different manner. Here we care that the name on the test corresponds to the same person who actually filled out the form. And the third case are elections, which are relatively similar to anonymous surveys. So now that we're all familiar with what bubble forms are, I'd like to take you through a prototypical example. So here's a common bubble form that you might find on the first page of a standardized test, where the respondent is asked to print their last name for identification purposes, and they're also asked to mark bubbles corresponding to each letter in their name. So there's quite a bit of information being conveyed here, namely the claim of the respondent's last name, and also the bubbles that are marked. Now here in our case, we don't care so much about what the fact that a particular bubble is marked means, but we care about what we can learn from the bubbles themselves. So if you take a closer look at marked bubbles, they might look something similar to this. And some high-level observations here are that they're all relatively homogeneous. We ask the user to fill in a circle, so they're going to basically follow the outline of the circle. And they're all going to be relatively the same color. Most bubble forms are filled in using a pencil, usually a number 2 on standardized tests. Now, what's interesting here is if I told you that these bubbles were marked by somebody in this room, and I asked you to tell me who it was, your first response might be, that's really difficult. And it doesn't seem like there's enough identifying information here. And the reason this seems difficult is because we all think, or have a pretty common assumption that about marked bubbles. And that is that marked bubbles on their own, out of context, don't have any identifying information. And more explicitly here, the assumption is that bubbles that are marked by different respondents, the variations between marked bubbles, are not detectable or are too inconsistent to allow us to deduce identifying information. Now, because I'm standing here, you might have surmised that the reality isn't quite that simple. And in fact, the reality is that within a single form, respondents tend to mark bubbles in a detectable and a consistent manner. And this can allow the respondent's identity to be revealed. So to illustrate why this false assumption can have real-world consequences, I'd like to tell you a little story about Alice. Now, Alice is a voter in a county that cares deeply about transparent elections. And following the election, Alice's county releases scans of the ballots. And these ballots are posted online so the general public can view them. And the thought is that by allowing the general public to view these scanned ballots, they're able to perform their own manual recount, thus verifying the results of the election. And one county that does this is Humboldt County here in California. So now, like any good citizen, Alice voted in the previous election, and she was given a bubble form ballot that was probably scanned on an optical scanning machine. And she made her selections in the various races uncoerced, and then placed her completed ballot in the stack with the other previously completed ballots. Now, Alice's assumption here is that because she filled in a bubble form, her answer selections remain known only to her. Now, about this time, Alice also happens to be looking for a job. And this is Mallory. And Mallory's a potential employer of Alice's. And Mallory prefers employees who have a particular set of political beliefs. It doesn't matter which one. And Mallory cares so much about these political beliefs that she's willing to undermine the secrecy of potential employees' previous election results. So Mallory has access to the scan ballots from the previous election, and she's going to rank prospective employees based on how they voted on a particular issue. So Mallory's going to take these ballots that she got from the completed ballots from the previous election, and she's going to scan them in using a regular desktop scanner. Any reasonable quality scanner will do. In our experiments, we scan images at a range of resolutions from 1200 dpi all the way down to as low as 10 dpi. Next, Mallory's going to take these scanned images, and she's going to use standard image processing techniques to identify where bubbles are located on the page and to extract the set of completed bubbles. So at the end of this step, Mallory's got a set of bubbles that came from each page, and she's going to classify each bubble based and give it an ID, which corresponds to the order in which she scanned in the forms. So as we saw before, bubbles tend to be relatively homogeneous in shape, and there's not an obvious method that allows us to distinguish between bubbles. So we're going to take a hint from the machine learning community, and instead of trying to develop our own technique, we're going to co-opt other techniques, and we're going to generate feature vectors for each image. Now, a feature vector for an image is just a set of numbers that's meant to convey the uniqueness or some distinguishing characteristic of the input image. And this is, we're going to distinguish them between other bubbles in the set. So we used a combination of three techniques. The first is PCA, or principal component analysis, which is a common technique that's used to take high dimensionality data like images and to distill them down into a set of numbers that are of a much lower dimension, on the order of 100, that convey the unique or most distinguishing properties of that image. But PCA is a very general technique. It doesn't know anything in particular about images, and it works well, but it doesn't do the full job. So the next thing we did is we used a technique called shape descriptors, which knows about the border region of a marked bubble. And here we're measuring things like variations in the radius of the region that the respondent marked, where the center of mass of the bubble is, and things like that. But this still doesn't capture all the information that we could get from a bubble. So to supplement that, we developed a technique based on color distribution. So here we're basically measuring how dark bubbles tend to be in different sectors around the circle. So does it tend to be darker in the bottom left than in the bottom right? Do they leave a certain section lighter or darker than others? So what we do is we combine the outputs of each of these three techniques and create a single feature vector that describes each bubble. So now we've got feature vectors that are labeled with the form ID that their originating bubbles came from. And we're going to take these feature vectors and put them through a machine learning algorithm. And in our experiments, we used a machine learning algorithm called sequential minimal optimization, which is a supervised learning algorithm that's used to infer the distinctive features. And it's basically just a fast way to train SVMs. So the important thing you need to know here is that once a model has been trained on a set of input images and their classes, when you provide the model with a new set of inputs, what it's going to generate is an output, which is an ordered list of form IDs that are ranked by the confidence the model has that the input images most likely correspond to each of the classes. So we're just guessing here. The model's guessing the probability that the new form falls into each one of the possible categories. All right. So back to Alice and Mallory. So remember, Alice is looking for a job, and Mallory is potentially offering her one. So Mallory gives Alice an employment application, which is, of course, a fill-in-the-bubble type form, which Alice dutifully completes and then hands back to Mallory. Now, Mallory's going to repeat a process similar to what I just described. She's going to scan the employment application in, extract the bubbles, generate feature vectors, and provide these feature vectors as input to her previously trained model. And what the model outputs is a ranked order of the ballots that the model was trained on. And here, the model shows that Alice's bubbles are most similar to ballot with ID number 3, the first one in the list. Now, the ability of Mallory to rely on the model's results depends on how accurately the model is able to capture the feature vectors of the bubbles it was trained on. So we ran some experiments, and we tested a slightly more limited scenario than what I just described. What we tested was how consistent are people at filling out bubbles that came from the same form, from the same survey. And we're currently working with a large agency to test how consistent features are over a longer period of time. So what we did to experimentally test this technique is we got a set of surveys that were taken of high school students. And these surveys were unrelated to our study. They didn't know anything about filling in bubbles or any stuff like that. And all the identifying information was removed. And here's a page from one of the surveys. In case you're curious, they're asking questions about the student's study habits, their food intake, and how well they slept before exams, things like that. We had to eliminate some surveys, either because they were incomplete, the students didn't answer all the questions, or they were filled in using pen, which was against instructions. So this left us with 92 surveys that met our criteria. And these surveys had bubbles that had numbers inscribed on them. Instead of like a circle with the letter A, B, or C, they had numbers 1 through 5. And we took steps to avoid training on this particular set of features in our experiments. So from each of the 92 surveys, we chose 20 bubbles at random. And of these 20, we put 12 of them in a training set, where each was labeled by the form ID, the order that we scanned the forms in. And we took the remaining 8 and put them in a test set. And we trained the model just as I described. And once the model was trained, we took the set of 8 test bubbles from each respondent and used those as input. And what we got out was a ranked order of the bubbles corresponding to the classes that the model was trained on. And here, these test bubbles came from Form 14. And you'll see that Form 14 is the third highest rank in the list. So the way we measure accuracy here is we are basically measuring how high in the list is the correct respondent found, and with what percentage is it at or above a certain rank. All right. So, and we repeated this experiment for all 92 respondents, and we repeated it a number of times, so we got an accurate representation of the accuracy of this technique. So, before I describe to you the exact results, I want to describe this graph. Along the x-axis is the rank that the correct respondent was found, and on the left-hand column is the percentage of the time that the correct respondent was found at or above a given rank. So in the previous example, Form 14 was ranked number 3, so the correct respondent was found at rank 3 or greater. So, and the blue line that you see here is what we would anticipate seeing if we were guessing randomly, that is, if bubbles contain no identifying information. And we do significantly better than random guessing. And our results show that an individual can be identified with an accuracy significantly that of above random guessing. So with random guessing, if we took our top choice and just went with that, we would be correct about 1.1% of the time. And in our experiments, if we take our top choice, that person is the actual respondent over 51.1% of the time. If we take a look at the top 3, we find our correct respondent is there 75% of the time. And if we look at the top 10, the respondent is there 90% of the time or greater. So we think this is pretty good. But I want to go back to what I spoke about earlier, which is about the resolution that we scanned the ballots at. So the previous data was scanned at 1200 DPI, or generated from images scanned at 1200 DPI. But that resolution might be too high for certain applications. So to measure the impact that resolution had on our results, we scanned it, we downsampled our 1200 DPI images to resolutions at 600, 300, 150, and 48. So as a point of reference, our best guess accuracy with 1200 DPI scans was at 51%. And we didn't see a significant decrease until we got down to around 150 DPI, which only decreased to 45% as our best guess accuracy. And at 48 DPI, we still do pretty well at 36.4%. And we even did non-trivially at DPIs as low as 10 DPI. So there are a number of applications for a technique like this. We've seen one scenario as it applied to elections where it could be used to undermine Alice's secret ballot. An alternative positive use is this could be used to detect fraud. If we had have a set of 100 surveys, we could see whether two surveys have bubbles that are filled out by, that have feature vectors that are too similar to one another, suggesting that the same person probably filled out both forms. And surveys are relatively similar to elections. But I'd like to spend the most of the rest of the talk talking about applications for standardized testing. And although the headline here is often undermining the secret ballot, I think the impact of standardized testing might be just as significant, if not more so. So standardized tests wrestle with the problem of how best to detect cheating. And cheating can be performed by the student taking the exam knowingly, or can be done after the fact, perhaps by a teacher. And there was a recent controversy in a number of cities about teachers adjusting student exams. But this basically boils down to the scenario where Alice completes the SAT exam, but a surrogate takes the exam for her. And how best are we able to detect that, that difference? So one way to detect cheating might be to train a classifier just as we did before. But here, instead of labeling forms by some unique ID, here we actually know the true respondent's name. So we're training models based on previous examples of how people filled in bubbles. And now when we're our model is provided an exam that claims to be taken by Alice, the model outputs a ranked order of candidates that have feature vectors of bubbles most similar to Alice. And the idea here is to determine whether we think Alice is a cheater or might have cheated, is we're going to set a threshold, and if an arbitrary threshold. And if Alice's ballot, if the bubbles that claim to be Alice's fall above this threshold, then all's good. They look like Alice's bubbles. We can be have a little more confidence in the results. If Alice falls below this threshold, then this is suggestive that Alice, that somebody might have taken the test on Alice's behalf. All right, so we're basically measuring how similar are the input bubbles to Alice's. So with a setup like this, we can basically make two kinds of mistakes. The false positive, where Alice took the exam, but we set the threshold such that Alice's bubbles are classified below this threshold, which mistakenly labels her a cheater. Now, the alternative case is the false negative case, where a surrogate takes the exam, but we set the threshold so that a lot of people can fall above this threshold. And if somebody took the exam in Alice's place, they would escape detection. So it's common in these scenarios, as we've seen in previous talks, to graph how the false negative rate corresponds to the false positive rate. So here's how we do in practice with the same limitations that I talked about before. And these results were generated from the 1,200 DPI scans. So we expect the false negative rate to increase linearly, and that's just due to how the experiment was set up. And you'll see the false positive rate drops quite rapidly. And they intersect at about an 8.8% error rate. So here we're considering the top 9 candidates. If Alice doesn't fall in the top 9, then that's suggestive that she might have cheated. Now, in reality, we would probably set this threshold a little differently so as to avoid looking at 8.8% of all the tests that we see. And we might want to just look at the most egregious cases. So I want to talk a little bit about what we can do to mitigate this risk, the risk of bubbles identifying you. The first step, the first thing we can do, is we can change the procedures around access to completed surveys, ballots, or standardized tests. We could reconsider whether it's really necessary to provide broad access to the results or to the resulting ballots or surveys. But for a number of reasons, as in some of the county election cases, this is not desirable because we want to provide access to the ballots to the general public so they can have confidence in the results. So the second thing we might do is we might change the scans before we release them. In the case of election ballots, we might want to mask the marked bubbles using some automated technique or even a manual technique. And there are various algorithmic techniques that claim to remove the identifying information from a set of images. But the problem here is that you're actually removing the information that you want people to see, namely the fact that it looks like a person filled in a bubble. And if they have to believe, that the computer marked it accurately, then they're already trusting you to do some adjustment of the scans. So the third and slightly longer term solution is to actually change the forms themselves. And this is an example of an image that was a little bit difficult for our algorithm to detect where the border was, And that's because there's a kind of a flourish that goes off to the left. And this happened on the case where there was a stippled and slightly grayed background. Some alternative changes you might make to forms, besides just changing the background color, are that you could make the border region of the bubble quite a bit thicker. And this would discourage people from making markings outside the bubble. While you could still have the ability to see that a bubble is marked, it'd be tougher to determine their border. Secondly, you could decrease the resolutions that you're releasing bubbles, be releasing the scans at. You could just generate black and white scans instead of grayscaled results, and that might help to mitigate the risk in the short term. So as a quick summary, this work demonstrates that bubbles might not have the strict anonymity claims that we all previously assumed they had, and it casts doubt on the true anonymity of surveys or ballots. And we've seen that there are some positive use cases, both in the election or survey scenario, and particularly for the standardized test case. And we're currently exploring and getting access to more longitudinal data. So with that, I look forward to your questions. Thanks.
Yeah. Do both your testing and training data come from at the same time, from the same test, on the same paper?
Yes. So the surveys that we got were, I think, about 10 pages long. Okay. And so they had multiple questions on each page. And we only had access to the forms that were taken on a particular day. Right. With a particular time span.
So going back to your original motivating example, you're saying that the same person first voted in the election, and later she took an employment application.
Yes.
So in this case, she probably have used two different pens.
Yes.
And she marked on two different papers.
Yes.
And she did it on two different days.
Yes.
So I suspect that some of your analysis will not work as well. For instance, your color analysis, when you use different pens, the intensity will be different. If you write on different papers, then those kind of vision analysis will be different. So I'm just wondering what your thought about this.
Okay, I'm going to take all of those in turn. First, we did experiments in our lab where we had people swap pencils when we were taking exams, and we did this. This was not an ideal experimental situation because people knew what they were doing. But the pencil that was used did not seem to contribute to our accuracy at all. Second, as far as the particular paper that was used, what I didn't mention is that when we were identifying the border region or the color, we tried to subtract out what we thought the background color of the paper was. So at this scan, at this DPI, we can make a pretty good prediction as to what the background region is. Also, we blurred the images when we were generating the border region because that helped. So there are a lot of details a lot of steps we took to prevent training on things like the particular paper or the particular pencil that was used. Now, as to your underlying claim that the people are going to fill in ballots differently on day one than they will on day 20, that's something that we're currently exploring. And the anecdotal evidence that we have suggests that people are relatively consistent in the way they mark bubbles. So did I hit all of your points?
Yeah, so I guess my suggestion is that it would be nice if you repeat your experiment by in a more realistic scenario where you have the same person doing the two different surveys on two different days, different papers, using different pens.
Yes. So we're currently looking into that, and it turns out that people who give out these surveys usually don't do it on multiple days. They're usually interested in things like sexual history or something like that. And to take surveys of human subjects on a large time span requires IRB approval, and that can get a little bit difficult. So we're looking into that. If anybody has a relatively large number of surveys that were taken on multiple days by the same participants, we would love to talk to you.
Well, you are at a university, so you have undergrads, don't you?
Yes.
So kind of in the same vein, did you investigate the consistency of the scanning options? I mean, if you're using even the same scanner on different days, you can get different results. I mean, I guess it kind of boils down to normalizing your data sets.
So a couple of things. I'm pretty familiar with scanners. And scanners are engineered to be as consistent as they can over time. And so if you scan today, it should be the same results as you scan tomorrow. And And that's basically an engineering problem. We used the same scanner, and most of the forms were scanned. Well, different forms were scanned throughout a significant period of time, because it just takes forever to scan the same thing. But we blurred the images before we were generating any of the results, so that tends to blur out any scanner-dependent features we might find.
Even a miscalibrated scanner? I mean, assuming you control the scanner, then yes, it sounds fairly straightforward to keep things normal, but imagine you're looking at archives scanned by an unknown scanner or what have you.
So we didn't explicitly explore the same ballots scanned on different scanners and compare scanner one's feature vectors that were generated against scanner two's. So that's something we didn't do, and that's something we should explore.
Thank you.
I don't know who was first.
I was going to ask, do you have any idea how this would work if you were using like daubers instead of pens?
Yes. So I forgot to mention that one alternate mitigation strategy is for people to, instead of using pencils, is to either use like a felt tip marker that's going to leave a permanent mark that's more random than somebody filling it in. So that's one alternative mitigation strategy.
I was wondering about the emotional state of the person taking the test. If you're taking an SAT, you may be emotionally very different than if you're filling out a survey about whether you like Wheaties or granola, and that may very well affect how you fill out the bubbles. You may be very, very careful in an SAT and sort of not with some other things, and it may apply to elections as well.
Yes, I would agree with you that there is a chance that somebody's emotional state could change how they fill in bubbles. I think a more interesting case is if somebody's taking the SAT multiple times, say in the spring and then in the fall, they're probably going to be relatively the same amount of nervous both times, maybe a little less nervous the second time. But what you want to do there is to compare the feature vectors from the first SAT against the feature vectors from the second SAT, and to make sure that they're close enough to each other that it looks like they were the same person. So that might adjust for some of that, although it's a slightly different case than what you described.
So basically, it seems like you're characterizing somebody's sort of bubble signature.
Yes,
and,
exactly.
If you have an election, there tends to, there are thousands, maybe tens or hundreds of thousands of ballots. And do you think that you'll actually be able to characterize the signatures well enough to identify sort of single ballots out of very large sets? Like if it's only 100 and you have to sort of find one, it seems like you might have enough sensitivity to do it.
Yes.
But will you be able to do it with much larger numbers like ballots, given maybe enough sampling?
So precinct size is kind of an interesting thing to look at. So precinct sizes can vary rather widely from a few hundred to up to 1,000 or so. But what's interesting is that election turnout on a particular day is usually quite low, on the order of a third to 40%. So we're still roughly on the same order of magnitude of the number of users that you would see in a typical off-year election. So that's something that we're looking at, and as far as the ability to identify a single ballot, you have to take the model's prediction with the caveat that it's not a 100% predictor, and as we saw, the range can vary depending on where you set your threshold. But in a close race, you could look at the top few candidates and make a prediction as to how you think the person voted.
I'm going to let Peter take the last question.
Sure. Peter Neumann, I was going to think that you were going to answer a little bit differently. One thing comes to mind, and that would be that in a place in which the number of entries is very small. For example, an anonymous suggestion box, which includes the ability to do things like whistleblowing, where you really don't want to know who the hell anybody to know who you are. In that case, you might really be able to do something quite effective. On the other hand, if you really are trying to have anonymous questionnaires, there are many other ways that are much easier than trying to analyze the bubbles. For example, invisible ink, serial numbers, and all sorts of other embedded things that steganography, for example.
Yes. So if I was taking an anonymous survey and I really wanted it to be anonymous, I would photocopy the sheet of paper so I controlled the individual sheet of paper. Secondly, you kind of have to trust the person who's giving you the anonymous form that it is anonymous, and that when you hand it in, they're not going to secretly mark, you know, that was Will who filled out this questionnaire, and to look at it later. So there are a couple of procedural changes that you can make and things that you as an individual can do to try to mitigate the risk that you're going to be revealed.
Yeah. But again, this is very interesting work from the point of view of covert channels and mm-hmm. Out-of-band signaling and all sorts of other ways of hiding information. Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, well, please join me in thanking Will and all our speakers.